And thanks, folks, for coming. I'm going to stay seated at least for a little while. This is my first non-alcoholic, or my second non-alcoholic event. Evidently, it is very much in keeping these days to serve alcohol in book-selling venues. It seemed to me to be a good idea. Because you would think an imbibing crowd is a happy crowd, an imbibing crowd is a crowd that's going to buy some books. So I was in Richmond at Kelly Justice's store, Fountain Books, and we go next door to this bar, and so I get through, and this lady who is knee-walking drunk, I mean really impaired, approaches me. She was the last person in line, and it was late, and she says to me, I'd like you to sign the book. And so I signed the book, and as I say always, and it's not rote, I mean this, it's heartfelt. Thank you for buying the book. I hope you enjoy it. And she slurs out to me, I don't intend to read it. I bought it because I felt sorry for you. and she's drunk, and it's this non sequitur. I don't understand what she meant. And I try to pin her down to get some other response, and she just staggers out of the door. I never understood what she meant. So it did sort of wound me a little bit. So the rule tonight is no pity buys, please. No pity buys tonight. The other funny thing about so far with the stops with this book, I don't mind public speaking because I do it because I'm a judge. It doesn't bother me. You might not be able to tell, but it doesn't bother me. But I cannot do television, and I do not know why. And I freeze up. So we're in Jackson, Mississippi last week, and we go into the radio station to do my little live gig, and we're in the control room. They don't have a green room. It's that kind of TV station. It's the control room. You just sit back there. And in fact, and I'm not sure how to pronounce the name, but I think it's Wobleski, David Wobleski, who did Edgar Sawtell, was there at the same time I was. So we were shooting The Breeze, and he seemed quite relaxed, and he goes on. He does his bit, and everything's good. And I go on. What reminded me of this is putting this apparatus on, the recording mic that I have on now. And so I go to do my little thing, and the first mistake I make is looking at the monitor, because I see myself on the monitor, and I'm thinking the backdrop should be a spaceship because I look like a damn alien. It is just awful. And so now I'm nervous and unnerved at the same time. And I get through. I do my little 4 minutes, pretty much like the Tin Man the whole time. And we're driving off, and we're headed to the next stop, and Knopf was nice enough to let my wife travel with me on that leg. And I said to her, I need an objective assessment. How did I do? And she's quiet, and she said, you got the name of your own book wrong. And I said, I couldn't have. I mean, how could I do that? And she said, well, you did. And she said, the people in the control room did the double snap. What is he talking about? And I got the name of my own book wrong. And then they put the graphic up with the right book, and I'm sure that really moved a lot of merchandise for Random House. I'm sure they're really happy. Everybody's scratching their head. What do we want to buy? So I drove here today, and we were talking earlier. I'm not a big reader, and in fact, usually, I know some of my friends have heard me do this before. I really don't even talk about my books normally, but I am this time. I'm going to talk about The Legal Limit just a little bit. And when I wrote this book, I wanted to do essentially three things. Number one, I think the most important thing that you can do as a writer is entertain people. And I think that writers have forgotten that to some extent. And I like novels. I call them slam bang novels. I like novels that have a lot of plot, a lot of momentum, high banks, and trap doors. I like novels that have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And when you get to the end, there's a conclusion and a payoff. As you progress there, there are little, perhaps, side roads that will give you some enjoyment. I do not like writing that is elliptical and inaccessible. The kind of writing you see, and there are, I don't know, 17 pages describing the stepping stones that make their way up to your aunt's cabin. That's a little too introspective to me. So as my pal Tom Wolfe says, as writers, the first thing that we need to do is make sure we entertain people. And that's paramount for me in writing any book. And I like to think that this book has a lot of plot and a lot of entertainment. Number two, when I wrote this book, I am not in a unique position, but I am in a good position to give folks insight into the legal system. And I think people have a real interest in the legal system and what goes on. And I think the legal system, the courtroom in particular, is a wonderful backdrop for a human drama. It is a crucible to sort of cook up all sorts of human emotion. And in this book, what I wanted to do was to highlight what I call the ugly salt between law and justice. And I wanted to put the reader in the position of a judge or a juror. And if I've done this right, if I structured it correctly, what will happen is you will, I hope, be entertained. You'll read, and I can't tell you exactly where the juncture comes in the book, but say 300 pages in. And then you will get to a point in this book where I hope you are transported into the novel, and you will become a judge or a juror with this very difficult situation. I like to say that most writers, myself included, can take you to the county fair, and we can tell you what the tilt-a-whirl looks like. But what I want to do is take you to the county fair and put you on the tilt-a-whirl. The tension that I'm talking about in this book is, how much do we break the law, massage the law, whittle it down? How much do we cheat to do justice? Let me give you a general example of what I'm talking about. And there are some lawyers in the audience, and this will ring familiar with them. In Virginia, we have what are known as mandatory minimum sentences. And that means that if you do the crime, you pay the time. Or you do the crime, you do the time, I should say. And the bottom line is that there is no discretion vested in the judge. One of the mandatory minimums we have in Virginia is a mandatory minimum of 2 years in the penitentiary for the possession of a firearm by a nonviolent felon. Stated differently, if you're a felon and you have a gun, you go to the jail, you go to the penitentiary, excuse me, you go to the penitentiary for 2 years. No suspended sentence, no questions, no exceptions. Here is a variation of a theme that I see in rural Patrick County, where I live as a judge. A gentleman whose surname, and this was about 3 or 4 months ago, a couple of these details I'm not positive about, but this happens more than once. A gentleman whose surname is Turner, and by the way, this is not confidential, this is not in any way something that I shouldn't be talking about, it's public record, so I am not telling you anything that is unethical for me to disseminate, comes into court, and he is charged with possession of a firearm, and he's a convicted felon. Mr. Turner was hunting, and he was hunting with a black powder rifle. I don't know how many firearms folks we have, but that's about like a musket. It's a hunting rifle. In Mr. Turner's papers are in order. The game warden is doing his job. There's nothing uncommon about that. He checks him. He has a license, proper stamps. Everything is good. But then we discover, as the game warden continues, that Mr. Turner is, in fact, a convicted felon. He's charged with possession of a firearm after being a convicted felon, and he arrives in my court. He arrives in court, of course, with probably 3/4 of his church. Mr. Turner is not one of the defendants who found the Lord on the courthouse steps like so many others. Mr. Turner had been involved in his church for a number of years and, in fact, helped them do the drywall. Not only did he do the drywall in his church, but he had done it all over our community for other churches. He has had no criminal convictions since his early 20s, 20-some years old when he got his first conviction. And there sits Mr. Turner with his church. And my job is what? Give him 2 years in the penitentiary. Here's the punchline. Guess what his felony was as a young man? Making liquor. He's a moonshiner. Now, the law says, the law is clear, and the legislature tells me that's 2 years. Put him in the penitentiary for 2 years. I have no discretion. There are no back doors. There are no tricks. There's no way to whittle it down. My choice is to do justice or follow the law. And that's what this book is about. And of course, I hope it's more entertaining. And it's writ much larger on a bigger stage because the case in the book is obviously a murder case. So that was the second thing that I wanted to do. And by the way, in Mr. Turner's case, I found him guilty of disorderly conduct, and fined him $100. I broke the law to hopefully do justice. But that is the second issue that I really try to address in the book, and that's one of the big themes. And as I say, I hope that you will be transported in the book as a reader, and when you get to that juncture in the book, you will have to make this decision. I think the fun part of the book is, for people who've read it, people will disagree about the ultimate outcome of the book. People will have different opinions as to the correctness of what the judge and the Commonwealth attorney in the book do. That's the second thing. The third thing that I wanted to do is invest the book with realism. Now, let me preface this all by saying this book is fiction. Whole parts are made up. I do not want to end up on a TV talk show with the hostess wagging her finger in my face and saying, "This is all fiction, you made this up." It is. It says underneath legal limit, a novel. That having been said, this book is based on three or four big plot lines that actually happened. They occurred in Patrick County, where I live. And I say in the introduction to the book that many people will know, many readers in Patrick County will know the people and the places and some of the events. It is no secret, and one of the real easy giveaways, there's only been one Commonwealth's attorney in Patrick County ever indicted. And I don't mind giving that one away, and that would be my dad. So that's not going to be a real hard, that's not a real tough puzzle. That won't be very obscure for folks from my part of the world. And the fun part of writing this was to write in, there are clues and hints all through the book, including things embedded in the cover that will tell you where these stories come from or where the basis for some of these plot lines. But the reason I wanted to do that is because, number one, as I say, I hope this will be a good ride for people, and I hope you'll enjoy it. And number two, I hope that it will make you think about the big issue. And number three, when you get to the end, I want folks to understand that this isn't just abstract. This isn't just some textbook fiddle-faddle. This is a real problem that we see. And when you can feel that you've invested this time and maybe your perspective has moved just a little bit, but it's not the kind of thing you just put down and say, "Oh, well, this is just a novel." No, this is something that really happened, and some of these things really happened. The final thing that I want to say, and that's as much as I've ever said about any of my books, the final thing that I want to say takes that theme and expands it a little bit. And I know, again, a lot of people here will disagree with this, and I know that I am not objective. I have a vested interest in this. In fact, I know my friend Frank and I will quarrel about this later. It is embedded very much. It is just a mantra now. It is part of our public discourse. For people to say, for policymakers, politicians, everyone to simply say, "We want judges who don't make the law but simply follow the law." That's true, and I agree with that. And that is the system that we have, and that system of checks and balances is imperative to the courts working correctly, the legislative branch working correctly, and essentially our society working correctly. And I understand that. But there are 5 to 10% of cases and situations and factual scenarios where I'm not sure that is the best rule. And I would ask you to think about this chronology. If that were the rule, if the rule were that judges just followed the law, number one, African Americans could not vote in this country, or at least they would have significant impediments in terms of their right to vote. Now, I'm not going to comment on, I'm a state judge, I'm not going to comment on that. I don't think I should, or it's ethical for me to do that, or smart, all things given. But I'm just talking about on the federal system. If those judges had followed the law was it that there were serious impediments for African Americans to vote. But they didn't. They did not follow the law. In 1965, before Griswold versus Connecticut, it was a crime, and this seems mind-boggling to us now, it was a crime in the state of Connecticut for married couples to possess, own, or disseminate contraceptives. That Griswold versus Connecticut said that law is invalid and actually established, made, for lack of a better term of art, the fundamental penumbral right to privacy that is so controversial today. And most recently, and of special importance to us who live in the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountain in rural environs, like myself, if the Supreme Court had followed the law, then we would not have a fundamental Second Amendment right to have a firearm in our home. So, because the D.C. law said you can't. So when people say again and again, we just want judges who follow the law, I hope you'll reflect on that a little bit. And what we want are judges who are smart, fair, and use discretion wisely. And I know that we have a bad rap, and we deserve it. Judges deserve a lot of what they get. You see this sobbing, melodramatic judge in the Anna Nicole Smith case, and it was an embarrassment. You see Judge Lance Ito, and it wasn't good. But how about cutting them loose and giving the 95% of us who try to do a good job the discretion and the tools that we need to do our job? So, and again, that's what this book is about. And I don't want you to think it's didactic, it's heavy-handed, it's fun. The day it was released, the LA Times reviewed it and they said, it's fun that you can think about. And that's what I try to do, and that's the best sort of review that you can get. I'm not a good reader, but I'm going to read a page. I'm just going to read the intro to the book, which sort of sets the stage, and it talks about a few of the things that I just talked about, but it gives you a feel of the framework of the book, and it reiterates what I just said in terms of what I was trying to do. Some of you heard me say before, the first time I was ever asked to read, I was asked to open for Frank McCourt. And I was so proud. And then it just dawned on me why I got asked, because no one else wanted to do it, because he's so good. He is just delightful. He could read the phone book, and there I am up there trying to read. And then you leave, and you feel just small. And then the second time I read, I was in Washington at Politics and Prose, and my friend Charles Wright was with me. Not Charles Wright, the celebrated poet, my former roommate. And as I leave, I said, "How to do, Charlie?" And he said, "Well," he said, you just suck. And I was reading with Jay McInerney. I don't know how many people remember Jay or not. Jay was just—he's a great writer. But if you ever see him in person, he is handsome. He's charismatic. He doesn't look like an alien on TV. He is just magnificent. And I thought that the dull monotone that I used to read jury instructions would be just perfect. And evidently, that didn't really engage the crowd. As I said, the book is set up. This is just a little page. It's called Part 1, or page and a half. It's called Part 1. Part 2 is the novel proper, and then Part 3 is the sort of aftermath, another little note. And so here we go. I became a judge when I was 32 years old, and my first novel, The Many Aspects of Mobile Home Living, was published when I was 40. Given my interest in both law and writing, people have frequently encouraged me to put together a nonfiction insider's book about the legal system, a temptation I've always avoided for two main reasons. Most notably, I very much value the business of the courts and the importance of what we do as judges. And I believe that parting our velvet curtains to offer the world a wholesale view of the cogs, cranks, belts, braces, booms, and pulleys deep behind the stage is not necessarily a wise idea. Courts need a certain measure of dignity and, yes, mystique to function at their best. The great and powerful Oz was never the same after the dog embarrassed him, and without his mask, the Lone Ranger would be a run-of-the-mill do-gooder, just another guy on a fancy horse. Moreover, and at the risk of eroding that dignity and mystique, it's fair to say that day-to-day jurisprudence is a numbing, flat, repetitive affair, leavened with occasional spells of predictable farce and eye-rolling nonsense. On probation violation afternoons, for instance, the officers and clerks usually bet on which criminal with a dirty drug screen will be the first to claim, his right hand raised extra high for emphasis, he's the victim of some dude slipping cocaine into his coffee. Dudes are bad about giving away their dope as a prank. I always respond with a straight face while a $5 bill discreetly switches owners in the periphery. As an author, I've never seen where it would be worth the effort to chronicle such as this for 300 pages. My thoughts on not mixing law and literature lasted until 2003, when I changed my mind and decided to write about one of my cases and turn it into this book. At quitting time on a drab Thursday in November of that year, a deputy at the Patrick County Jail phoned and informed me there was someone who needed to speak with me, someone I knew. This call led to three lengthy meetings during which I became privy to a remarkable history, a narrative that was far more compelling than anything I could ever dream up, and it gradually occurred to me there might be a novel in the story that I'd been told. I was convinced I'd gotten the truth in these meetings, but I nevertheless spent the next few weeks quietly nosing around and checking the particulars. I spoke with a couple of the people involved, I read old files, studied transcripts, and took a trip to state police headquarters. Everything jogged. The legal limit, then, is not a literal diary of what I do as a circuit court judge. It's not quite the undertaking that my friends have suggested to me. But it is, at its core, a reasonably accurate account of lives and happenings I discovered only because of my job and wouldn't have come across otherwise. In terms of perspective and the angles I see from where I sit, this story should also give folks a taste of how it feels to make hard decisions, stick them in a lonely black robe, and situate them so they can understand how the correct answer, the right ruling, sometimes brings along its own tricks and complications. That having been said, this book is done as fiction. I cut several scenes from whole cloth, portions of dialogue or an educated guess as to the actual conversation, and names are tweaked or rearranged in places, although my friends in Stuart, Virginia won't have any problem deciphering who's who. A few parts are inverted, sort of written backward. Much of the small detail, however, is reproduced exactly, with only a minimum of writer's gloss. I was amazed by what people could recall two decades removed from events. A missing section of plaster in a room, a sound, a scent, an odd phrase, even the luckless kamikaze bird that introduces the first chapter. Simply put, there are plenty of facts in these pages, but I've definitely retooled them to serve the story that I wanted to tell. Finally, I suspect many people will find my choices in this matter troubling and disagree with how I determined to finish things, since my attempt in an act of conscience arguably doesn't square with the familiar black and white dictates of the law. Perhaps I made a mistake. Still, my predecessor on the bench, Frank Richardson, once advised me that a smart judge always has a little juju up his sleeve, even if the rules don't contemplate it and the parties don't see it coming. Every now and then, you're entitled to play the wild card, was how he explained it. Justice can occasionally be a fickle, blind bitch, and someone has to keep her honest. There you go. Always happy to answer questions.
Okay. Very good.
Yes.
Do you see yourself?
Well, I can tell you, and have you ever heard the line from my rejection letter? I won't run through the whole story because I got my first rejection letter in 1982 here in Charlottesville, and my plan was, again, Charles Wright and I, my friend, we wanted someone to help us. And I wanted someone to promote my manuscript in New York. So we go out in horse country here in Charlottesville. Charlie and I do, and we leave a manuscript and a bottle of liquor in a very famous author's mailbox. I was, I guess, second year of law school then, and the manuscript comes back about 6 weeks later with this letter, which I promised Charlie that I would, if we ever, either of us are ever published, we carry it with us always. And this is what it says, and this will answer your question perhaps. It says, in one paragraph, your book, and this is my first book, many aspects, your book is cynical and clever as to getting it published. I don't know much about that. That's what agents are for. This is not the person who's going to hold my hand and lead me through the literary labyrinth. And here is the last line. As to mixing law and literature, it would seem to me you'll either be a half-assed writer or a half-assed lawyer. Literature is a full-time passion. Sincerely, Rita Mae Brown. So maybe that answers your question. I'm not really very good at either one of them. No, my day job is absolutely critical. If I make a comma blunder or there's a dangling modifier, it really doesn't matter. But what I do every day affects people's lives, and I take that very, very seriously. And one of the things, and I not only the work itself, but the office. And one of the things I'm doing now, this is 30 cities on this book tour, and I plan it well in advance. I make sure my docket is clear. I have been on the phone doing conference calls between stops. I was actually in my office this morning, and even though I have the vacation accumulated, I do not get paid. I send my check back. It's fun trying to send. State has no problem taking your money. Try to send a check back to the bureaucracy. Even though I've done it for 3 books, it's the same thing. This time it was better. So I vocationally, I have to be a judge first. It's actually good to be a lawyer, the training, and that's an interesting question because when I was in Oxford last week, I was talking to Scott Morris, who's one of my favorite writers and probably someone you've not heard of. Scott is a really talented writer, and he was talking about a review he got. He was also talking about a critique that he had gotten, and I have had some of the worst reviews imaginable. And truly, I separate that out from what I do, and I think being a lawyer allows you to do that, and you know it's just work, it's just professional. I've had a review that I've read in the store before that we just cackled about that began, it was in 2000, it began by saying, "This is the worst novel of the year 2000. That's how it began. And then it went on to say, "Even though this is just June," I feel confident saying. It also illustrates, too, what a strange business this is. It is a business, in my estimation, like any other form of entertainment that's built on luck and timing. If that review, which was in the New York Journal of Law and Politics, had been in the New York Times, I wouldn't be sitting here now. That review was read by 15 or 20 people. Thank goodness. It was about 2 or 3 pages. It was a rant and a screech, but so help me, it didn't bother me. And actually, especially with my first book, some people said things that I thought were wise, and I wish I had done them. And if I could travel back and rewrite certain things, I would do it because they were very good suggestions. They made sense. So it doesn't bother me, but gosh, a lot of writers will tell you, "I don't read the reviews. They're so critical." I mean, they drive books, so you need good reviews. But I don't take them personally. And I think being a lawyer makes it easy. Well, I will, I'm sure, but if you read the book, and I've said this over and over, I love Patrick County. I love where I live. That's why I choose to live there. It is a wonderful place with wonderful people. I thank the world of Stewart and Patrick County. The people who are mentioned by name or obvious composites are people I adore, people I like. So that's not a problem, and I love the area. The villains in the book are truly just made up. They're just fiction. These aren't real people that you're seeing. Now, despite that, because it is a small town, someone will feel aggrieved. And I already have a report that someone is aggrieved for something that none of us would ever think about. And I will perhaps mention it when I'm not on the record, as we say in court. But just, you would never think of this. And this person is incensed. Not someone even mentioned in the book, by the way. So it's pretty easy, and the feedback, I think people sense or know that I really like the area. I like the people I'm mentioning, and the feedback in Patrick County has been good, very good. Well, one of the things I don't want to do is give that away. I will simply say this, that there are hints in the book, and more importantly, it is based on a real case. And there is a character in the book who can tell you what the case is. And that's all I'm going to say. Because, I think that sometimes as writers, we I know when I watch a movie, I don't want to go back and see how they did it. And I don't want to see the computer-generated stuff and the green screens. And I don't want to know where all the strings are. I think that I don't like people to deconstruct what they do so much. I'm not quite Cormac McCarthy like that, who says, the book says what it says. You know, and if Oprah wants to talk to me, she can come to my house, which was really cool. And he has always been that way. But I think that you do need a little gloss, and you need something that's hidden a little bit to make it work. But so that's all I'll say. Several people have asked me, I don't know about a murder in 1984 that remains unsolved. That's true. This story has been shaped, but it does have, as a take-all point, a real case that I did, and there's one character in the book who precisely knows who it is, and that's why I put him in the book. I write in the mornings. I get up at 6 o'clock, and I enjoy writing, so I'm not doing anything now, obviously, but I get up and I write a page or two a day and enjoy doing it. I know it's probably sort of a 50-50 split. My favorite writer was the late Larry Brown. Larry died at 53. But he wrote, maybe this is why he died at age 53, Larry would write in these huge bursts. Larry would start about 1 in the morning, get all fueled up on whatever was at hand, and end up eating ice cream, seriously, at noon the next day, and very prolific in burst. But I'm not like that. I have to write every day, and I think most professional writers have a pattern, and you get up and you do it. It's like, in a certain sense, a job, though it is not unpleasant for me. And I think that a lot of people I talk to now say, I want to write because I want to make money. I want to write because of any number of reasons. I don't think you're going to get there. I think you really got to like doing it. You got to feel you have a story to tell, and you got to want to do it. How many people have I heard say, it took me so long to get published? I mean, I'm not in that category alone. And why do they keep doing it? It certainly couldn't be because they're getting rich. It's because they like doing it. So I like doing it. I get up every morning. I think it would be easier just to make it up because you don't have any boundaries. One of the things that, I don't know how many folks here read the book, but one of the things that I'm proud of, a number of people have approached me and they said, well, one thing we know for sure is that you have a teenage daughter, and in this book, because this is my daughter. I was at church Sunday. Two women told me that, and one of them said, this is my daughter. This is Holly Williams. She said, this is my daughter. And I don't know, were you in our house? And I don't have any children, and I don't have a 15-year-old daughter. So it is much more fun to make the characters up. And then if you totally make them up and they resonate with someone, then you feel good as a writer. This book I wrote in 3 years, which is slow by industry standards, even though it's out in 4 years. It was in the pipeline a year, which is not, it's not like it's a bad movie. You know, you can, we're going to delay the, it's just, that's commonplace. They stay in the pipeline, I mean, 9 months to a year. But it took me about 3 years to get it done, about 3 years. And again, that's slow, but I wouldn't write any faster. I don't think I would be any quicker if I didn't have a day job. I just do, that's just the rhythm I'm in. So my first book was out in 2000, 2004, and then 2008. Well, I want to, and I had planned to, and there were some complications, and my term's up in about 2.5 years, and I want to, and it's there. We just had some complications, where, you know, in our circuit, and it wasn't the right time, and plus, I really felt like I signed up to do a term. I love the job. I mean, I love the work. You can tell I'm very passionate about certain aspects of it. But I started when I was young. I was 32 years old, and I'll have 20 years in pretty soon. That's a long time to do it. And one thing you do not want to do as a judge is become jaded or hidebound. You need to, every day you go in, you need to be fresh and believe in what you're doing. So I can still do that. But I don't know. I'd rather fly fish and write books. If I can get a couple of things worked out, I might. Though, I tried it very briefly. I tried retirement. I had a medical malpractice case settling, and I had 10 days at home, and I did a lot of work the first day and got stuff done, accomplished a lot. The second day, I'm drinking coffee. It's raining outside, and I wasn't writing anything. I couldn't go fly fishing, so there I sit. And my wife comes in and says, what are you doing? I said, I'm drinking coffee and watching TV, and she said, you're on my last nerve. underfoot is the term. And I put my suit on, went to work, and organized the law library and helped the clerks file. I really did. Didn't have anything else to do. I was caught up at work. We are appointed by the legislature. We in Virginia mimic the federal model, and maybe I'll close on this because it's hot. But the when I was in Oxford, I never understand how you would run as a judge and what your platform would be. And Andy Horwath is a judge there, and I met him for the first time. His brother Richard runs Square Books, and his brother Richard is the mayor of Oxford and one of the neatest people I have ever met in my travels. I thank the world of him and his bookstore. And I said, well, how do you run as a judge? I mean, what kind of campaign do you have? What's the plan? And he said, well, here's my favorite judicial commercial in the campaign season in Mississippi. The judge's name is Pat. And the camera catches Pat walking down the breezeway of a jail. And the cells are empty. And Pat comes toward the camera, and he gets close to the camera, and he slams the jail cell door shut, clang. And he looks at the camera, and he says, tell him Pat sent you. So that's how you run as a judge, evidently in Mississippi. And our system's not perfect, but it's a good system, and I thank my... The men and women who serve as judges in the Commonwealth, I would match against anyone. I think we have some of the best judges, if not the best judges, in the world. So I'm proud of the folks I work with and proud of the job they do, and I think we have a good system. And that's coming from somebody who doesn't probably not going back before the legislature. So I don't have any investment in that one way or the other. All right. Well, thank you, folks, for. Thanks for coming out on a hot, sweltering day, and I appreciate it, and happy to sign books.